Brad, could you help me pass these out, please? Brad has the new ones that I just mentioned. You'll keep your hands up for that. He needs tonight too, don't you, Rick? All right. Excuse me. All right, we looked at chapter 1 on Sunday. And now we're looking at the second and third chapters where we're actually seeing Nehemiah lead the third return. Zerubbabel did the first one, Ezra did the second one. Time between the three returns we've already made mention of, and now we're in, thank you, we're in 445 B.C., and Nehemiah is ready to go back. He's received the report from Hanani, his brother, about the distressful conditions that are in Jerusalem among the remnant people and the city itself. We finished chapter 1 Sunday, how he was praying. He's in his mind already. He's got something he wants to do. He wants to go back and serve and to be of a help. So, it's the month Nisan. If I'm saying that incorrectly, then there you go. But that's how we'll pronounce it. On our calendar, it's around March or April. It's the first month on the Jewish calendar. Their months are numbered different than ours. How long has it been, therefore, since Hanani came to Nehemiah? First part of the first chapter. Anybody know? How much time has passed? It's about 4 months from when Hanani told him of the bad situation to now he's going to put his plan in action. Wonder why he waited 4 months. Speculation. But possibly waiting for the right time to approach the king about his plan. Maybe he had to have more time to formulate an action plan, if you will. Whatever the situation was, it's been 4 months since he learned of the conditions from his brother. Ezra chapter 4 also cannot prove this, but this is at least something else to think about. Remember in Ezra 4 and the verses that are sort of out of the chronological order in that chapter. But as you remember, apparently earlier on in Artaxerxes' reign, enemies or opponents of the remnant, recall they wrote that letter about they were not just busy rebuilding the temple, but also a lot of the other structures in the city. The walls were mentioned, Ezra 4 and verse 12, I believe it's verse 12. Anyway, they got the king to stop that process. And so it's possible maybe Nehemiah knew of that previous stoppage, if you will. And so perhaps he was waiting, trying to pick the best time to act. Again, go back real quickly to the last phrase of chapter 1, verse 11. What was the last thing he prayed about? What was his last request to God when he prayed? Grant me mercy, grant me compassion before this man. So he was planning this, and it seems to me, I don't think it's a stretch to say this, he's waiting, or has been waiting, for the perfect opportunity to make his request. He can't just up and go. I mean, he's got to have the king's permission. And so, for whatever reason, it's been 4 months since he received that report. Now, as we get to verses 2 through, we're going to put together 2 through 8, basically, here in chapter 2. We'll throw all that together and sort of call it, this is Nehemiah and Artaxerxes having this discussion or this exchange, if you will. Nehemiah records for us that he had not been sad in the king's presence. Now, someone would say, well, why do we have to know that? The book of Nehemiah doesn't tell us why that would be a sort of a big deal. I ask you to consider Esther chapter 4, verses 1 through 2, which is another book of the remnant. We cannot study that in this quarter. I'd like to put Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther all together, but there's not enough time to do that. So we had to pick two of them. But there's some information in Esther 4, verses 1 through 2. Now, it's a different king, and it's the king before Artaxerxes. It'd be Xerxes the first, or he's known in Esther as Ahasuerus. And apparently, if you look at those two verses, I'm going to conclude that it was Persian law that you couldn't do what? Yeah, you couldn't be sad, you couldn't mourn, you couldn't have a forlorn countenance in front of the king. The text there says that Mordecai only went so far. He did not go past the king's gate sitting on his sackcloth and in his ashes. Now, again, just real quickly, why was Mordecai mourning in that situation? What had already happened? That's right. Haman had got his plot ready to go, and Mordecai learned about it. And so he's mourning, he's sad. But apparently, just judging from that text, it was unlawful. The Persians, it was not right protocol, if you put it that way, to be sad, mournful looking in the presence of the king. And so here in Nehemiah's book, he says, the last phrase of verse 1, I had not been sad in his presence. But what happens in verse 2? That's right. The king notices. In fact, he asks his cupbearer. Now remember, this is a position where you're in the presence of the king. I mean, it's not like you're, you know, down the hallway in another office. You're right there at the throne. You're serving the king. And it'd be kind of hard to hide everything. And so Artaxerxes asks him. He sees this sadness and he inquires, why are you sad? Now, we know why Nehemiah is sad. He tells us. In fact, what does he tell the king? Why he's sad? Yeah, he said, let's just read his words there in verse... before we get there, the end of verse 2, what does Nehemiah also admit? Now, why would he be afraid? Well, perhaps it's this law that we're talking about. I shouldn't be showing the king my countenance. To me, that's the most logical thing to conclude. I can't prove it from the text, but that seems to me to be the best explanation. So, he says in verse 3, let the king live forever, sort of a respectful way to address the king. And then he says, well, why shouldn't my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire? Now, he just tells them, this is why I'm really not happy about things. My home city, my home country, the place of my father's tombs, the place of my ancestry, it's in really bad shape. And I'm not very happy about that. So he admits why he's sad there in verse 3. That's the text we're actually given. Then what does the king say? Well, Nehemiah, you have a job to do here, so just get over that. That's not what he said. What did he say? Now, Bobby, he says, what do you request? Do we take that to mean anything, that the king had some sort of an affection for Nehemiah? If he asked him, what do you request, what do you want? Does that imply anything? I think it implies a lot. He thinks enough of Nehemiah. Again, he's his cupbearer. He's this intimate, personal servant who's always in his presence. He's not some unknown servant he's got a boatload of those. This is the cupbearer. And he sees Nehemiah's sadness, and he's already asking, okay, what do you want? That tells you, Artaxerxes thinks a lot of Nehemiah. Thinks a lot of him. Oh, yes, that's a good point, Trent. It says there in verse 2, why is your face sad, though you are not sick? So there's some knowledge here between the two of them. So he admits why he's sad, and then the king says, you know, what do you request? Now, I think this is real important. Do not overlook that last short little phrase in verse 4. The last part of the verse. What's it say? It's a simple statement. He said a really quick prayer. You know, all our prayers don't have to be these long, drawn-out ones. What if you're thinking about and dealing with an immediate, specific task? What would be a good thing to do? Say a quick prayer about that. And that's what Nehemiah did. He prayed again. We read his beautiful prayer in chapter 1. Very, very beautiful prayer. Talked about that on Sunday, verses 5 through 11. But he says another quick prayer. And then what does he say? All right. Now, before we look at his answer, I'm going to connect this back to chapter 1, verse 11. His last phrase again was, grant thy servant compassion or favor in front of this man, or before this king. This is precisely what he had prayed for, isn't it? I mean, the king asked him, what do you want? Now is not the time to be what? timid. Now wasn't time to say, well, never mind. No. He had prayed about this. So I'm going to say, this is God. This is how God answered that first prayer. The king was open to him and just asked him, basically, hey, what can I do to help you? What do you need? What do you want? Tell me what you've got on your mind. And anybody can help him, it'd be the king. God's providence is all through this. Absolutely is. So this isn't the time for timidity. This is the time for bravery. This is the time for faithfulness. This is the time to act on one's faith. Don't go back. Let's go forward. So how did he answer the king? This is verse 5. Well, verse 5. What's his simple request? His direct request. Yeah. Send me back. Send me back to Judah that I may rebuild it. That's what I want. I want permission to leave my post and go back and rebuild that city that's lying in ruins. What's the next thing? And that's why we're saying this is an exchange. This is the dialogue. What's the next thing Artaxerxes says? And were these fair questions, by the way? Yeah, these are fair questions. I mean, you're in my employ. You're my servant. I'd like to know how long you're going to be gone. You know, tell me, don't leave me out here. Tell me all the things that you know so that I can make this informed decision regarding your absence from your job. So follow-up questions. How long will your journey be and when will you come back? You need my answering. Well, we don't have the information, but how does verse 6 conclude? Yeah, it says, so it pleased the king to send me, and I gave him a definite time, my version says. Yours may read a little different than that, but Nehemiah told him, this is what I know. Now, maybe some things he did know, he couldn't answer it, but what he did know, it's obvious that he shared that with the king. All right, so he answers them there at the end of verse 6. He gave definite details. He also requested two other things. This is through the first part of verse 8. All right, now, we've seen this with Zerubbabel, we've seen this with Ezra. They're making this trip back from Susa, from Persia, going, that would be what, southwest, roughly, on your map, back to Judea. And long way to travel, you get there, and here's this contingent of people coming from the northeast, and those who are already there, they're going to say, you know, who are you and what do you want? Well, they're carrying something. They're carrying royal permission, letters of authorization. So he says, I need letters to show the governors of the area what my business is, what my purpose is. And he asked for something else. Yeah, I need a letter to, I mean, his name is Asaph, the royal forest keeper. That's a good title. For what purpose? I'm going to need timber. I'm going to need lots of wood because I've got to build the walls. So I just can't walk up there and start chopping down trees. I've got to have permission to have these trees cut down and have the logs hewed out here and have them prepared for building. And I'm going to need permission to do that as well. So he requests those letters. Gates, well, yeah, the walls would be stones, but the gates would have wood support, wood frames on them. You're right. Okay. So Nehemiah has thought this through. And he's got his action plan ready to go. He was ready to give the king answers, hoping for the opportunity to make his request, and God provided it to him. And he didn't hesitate. Now, let's pause right there just for a moment and say, when we're in that situation, let's say we have prayed our heart out about something. Whatever that is that's at work in your life, and you're praying about it, and you're praying about it. Maybe you've asked like Nehemiah has. Maybe you've asked God for an opportunity to do something or to have some situation work itself around towards your favor, towards your good fortune. And you're just praying for the moment. And then God puts that moment right in front of you. What would be the wrong thing to do? Walk away from it. No, if you've prayed about it and that moment comes, then seize it. That's what Nehemiah did. It's exactly what he did. It's a good example to follow. And he's not arrogant, but he's not bashful. I mean, he's forceful about this. He's assertive. Our strong faith needs to be assertive when it comes to doing what we think the Lord wants us to do. So that's a good thing for us to think about. Okay, the king gets permission. That's the last part of verse 8 of this chapter. The king granted them to me. What's the reason Nehemiah gives? That's right. The good hand of my God was on me. He certainly gives God's providence all the credit for this. And this is similar to how Ezra credited God. We're looking at top of page 26. This is question 7. I'm not following the book too closely, but those verses there from Ezra's book, chapter 7, those three verses plus chapter 8, each time Ezra, something happened that worked out well for him, he said, the good hand of my God was on me, was in that situation. He credited God's providence. So, well, that's true. Maybe we claim too much for ourselves, Freddie. I think that's a good point to make. So let's not do that. Let's do what Ezra and Nehemiah did. All right, so Artaxerxes grants the permission. All right. Now, verse 9, Nehemiah arrives in Judea. This is question 8. What did he do when he gets to Judea? This is verse 9. All right. First order of business. He's got those letters. And he shows the governors of the surrounding areas. Here's who I am. Here's why I'm here. And basically, he's saying, I don't want any trouble out of you all. I'm here on the official, royally permitted business. And those letters were his ticket, if you will, so to speak. So it shows the letters of authorization. Verse 10. Now, here we have names you need to become very familiar with in this book. First time we see him is who? Particularly what two names? Sanballat and Tobiah. All right, Sanballat was a Horonite. And most sources that I read said that most likely refers to Beth Horon, which was an area about 10 miles north of Jerusalem, sort of on the borderline between the southern and northern kingdoms back in the divided kingdom days. And Tobiah was an Ammonite. Now, who were the Ammonites? Long history with them. Yeah, where'd they come from? Anybody remember? That's right. When Lot was, after he left the Sodom and Gomorrah and he fled to the caves for safety, his daughters got him drunk and got him to impregnate them, and one of the son's name was Ammon. So that's where the Ammonites come from. All right, so here's these two, and they're going to be the staunch enemies throughout this book of Nehemiah and all his efforts. They're not happy about Nehemiah's presence. Yes, go ahead. He had a military escort, didn't he? Yeah. And again, that shows that the king was on his side. So if anybody's gonna start messing around with Nehemiah, they're gonna have to take it up with the king, because he's there not on his own, but the king has sent him. That's a good point to make, Bobby. I overlooked that statement. Okay, so they are not happy. In fact, the text says these two were not happy because someone had come back to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel. They liked the Jews being down and out. Someone even suggests, one of the books that I read said that Sanballat basically was a Samaritan. So already we're seeing, again, how did the Samaritans and the Jews interact? Hey, there was no love lost between them at all. They didn't like one another. So they wanted Israel to be failing and not succeed, and they hear about Nehemiah coming, and they show their displeasure, they show their anger, it says. They're just displeasing to them. So that was his initial response when he comes to Judea. Now we get to verse 11, and we get a little more specific. Now we'll come to Jerusalem. So he gets to the territory first, then he gets to the city. How long did he stay there? He stayed 3 days before he did anything. So he's just there, maybe resting, maybe, I don't know, sort of looking around to see what the situation would be. And then he starts to act. He inspects the wall at night, doesn't he? And there's a couple of things we'll notice. This is question 10. We'll get to that just in a moment. But here's his action plan. And the King James says, and I found this interesting. The other versions don't say this. I don't know if the New King James says it or not. I didn't check it. But the King James says that I turn back in these verses. And that might indicate why you look at the map, and I've given you a diagram on page 28 of your lesson sheet, why he didn't go around the entire outline of the wall. He only did part of it. That may be an explanation why he only inspected the lower portion of it. So this on the screen is what you have here in your book, here on page 28. And quickly we see, and we're given enough information in these verses here in chapter 2, as to the gates that he inspected. There were several gates in the old Jerusalem wall. He started at the Valley Gate. He made a counterclockwise inspection. He goes from there down to the Refuse Gate or the Dung Gate, whichever version you have, it would be listed either way. From there he then goes straight east to the Fountain Gate. And notice it says in chapter 2 and verse 14, what happened at that juncture of the inspection? Yeah. Now, he says, all I've got is the animal I'm riding on. So, things are still torn up pretty bad. It's still just a pile of rubble and destruction. And he says, it got so bad that I couldn't even take my mount. So, he had to get off and walk by foot to finish this inspection at that particular juncture right there at the somewhere around the Fountain Gate. So from there, he then completes his inspection. And that's why, again, I'm saying in the King James, it says that I turned back. Maybe this is why he didn't go all the way on up here and complete the rest of the circuit. Maybe he saw enough. I don't know. Something else I want to share with you that I found in the Septuagint. At verses 13 and 15, this, of course, would be the Greek translation of the Old Testament Scripture. It says, in those two places, it says in the text that I mourned over the wall. So as he's making this inspection and he sees what's out there, if that be correct, how did it make him feel? He was just distraught. That it's just in this bad a shape. And seeing what he saw, it confirmed what Hananiah told him, right? Although it doesn't say that in the text. But when Hananiah came to Susa and talked to Nehemiah, that's the report that he got. And what was his initial reaction back then in chapter 1? He sat down and he wept for days. So now he's actually seeing the rubble. He's seeing the bad shape that it's in. And the Septuagint adds that information there. Now again, I'm no language scholar. I'm not saying that's in there or not. I'm just saying that's in the Septuagint. And that's something at least to consider. It certainly fits the tenor of the story. So he inspects the walls at night. Now, regarding these plans at verse 12, the first part of verse 12, and then also in verse 16, what do we learn regarding his plan? Yeah, he didn't tell anybody. Now, why do you think he made that decision? He didn't tell anybody what... In fact, he says in verse 12... I've told no man what my God was what? Putting in my mind. He didn't tell anybody. Why do you think he chose that route? Okay, trying to keep it from his enemies. All right. Maybe he didn't know what he was going to find. Maybe he thought, until I know what I'm up against here, maybe I ought to keep it to myself. That's a possibility. Whatever reason it was, he decided, let's go out here and I'm going to look it over. Myself and see what I'm up against. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. There's nothing wrong. In fact, it's oftentimes it shows some wisdom, doesn't it? When you're considering the doing of something, before you make all these big plans. Let me think about this. Let me look this over. And then I'll formulate a plan in my mind and we'll go from there. Well, maybe so. Maybe so, Brother Miller. Maybe he won't bother him. Do it under the cover of darkness. It's not that he's trying to hide anything. He's just thinking that maybe the best time for me to do this alone, like I've got in my mind to do it. That's certainly a possibility. So his decision not to tell anybody beforehand what God was putting in his mind. In fact, it also says the officials there in verse 16 did not know where I had gone or what I had done. They didn't even know why he was out there. Just that he's gone. And he's by himself out there inspecting the walls. He had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work. This is all just in his mind. Wheels are still turning. Okay, well, we come now to his exhortation. Verses 17 and 18. Okay, the inspection's over. The thinking's over. He's through formulating his plan. What's he say? Okay. He says he admits the conditions were bad. I mean, that's no shock. He just got there. And these folks have already been there for a while. So it's not like he's saying anything they don't already know. But he says that the conditions are bad. But I want you to look at the reason why he says we need. Well, first he says, come, let us arise and what? Let's arise and build. Let's get busy and build this. Now, what's the reason that he gives? That's right. We do not want to be a reproach any longer. We need to dig Jerusalem up out of the ashes here. She's a reproach. Why is it important that Jerusalem not be a reproach? It's God's city. It's the city that the Lord chose to make His name dwell. It's not that they chose it. God chose it. And I don't want this being a reproachful place any longer. This has the Lord's name on it. It's His city. So let's arise and build it. Yes. Yes. Yes, that's correct. Yes. That's right. And everyone's hometown means something to them to an extent. I mean, I know people change and move off somewhere and you establish roots somewhere else, but there's a little part of us all that we have this affinity for, you know, our home. But this primarily is not their home, it's God's home. It's His city. And that was important to Nehemiah that we remove this reproach, remove this blight. That's still a stigma, if you will, upon the city. Because this rubble, all this mess laying around, still bears testimony to what? Why is it in that state, that situation? Because it was destroyed because of why? Because of sin. Because of idolatry. And we get this cleaned up, we get this all straightened around, that'll certainly help the image of the city. So he also told them then, this is verse 18, I also told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. So he told them everything that he knew. He's exhorting them. He's encouraging them. Well, that's what he says. So what did they say? The end of verse 18. Let's do it. So he has found kindred spirits, hasn't he? He's found people who are thinking like him now. He's encouraging them. He's exhorting them. And they're saying, Nehemiah, we're with you. We're going to undertake this great... This is not going to be an easy task, is it? It's not like, I don't know, what would be something easy to build? They had no little bobcats or bulldozers, no whatever tools they had were crude, I'm sure. Most of it was just back-breaking manual labor. And it wasn't going to be easy. It wasn't going to be quick work either, so to speak. So he told them all these things, and they respond, "Yes, let's do it." Well, here we go back with the enemies again. They respond. They're going to react. Again, this is mainly Sanballat and Tobiah. Also, one other is named Geshem. He is an Arab. And how do they respond to all this? They mock. They laugh. What do they say there in verse 19? Now, where have we heard that before, Rick? That's right. Do you think they knew of that prior letter? We can't prove that they did, but I wouldn't be surprised if they did not know about it. And did the charge work back then? They accused Israel, the remnant, of rebelling against the king. This is the same king. It's Artaxerxes. It's the same Persian ruler. And he agreed to stop the work. So they may have been thinking, look, that accusation worked back then. Let's try it again. You're going to be rebelling against the king. What is this thing that you think you're doing? Well, Nehemiah's not going to be intimidated back there. But I think they try to use slander, an attempt that had been successful previously. And sort of a quick application here. This is the bottom of page 26. It's a question 12. Don't we face slander? I know we're not building walls today. I understand that. But we are building, aren't we? 1 Peter 2 says we're being built up a spiritual house. In that same context, that same chapter. What about those who speak evil of us? Slander, they mock us. 2 Peter 3, 1 through 3, the mockers come with their mocking, saying, "Where is the promise of His coming?" Mocking the idea that we believe the Lord's going to come back. So, we all have heard the mockings. We've heard the slanders. This is nothing new. God's servants have always faced this. Absolutely. God chose us. We're trying to serve Him. We're trying to engage ourselves in His work. And Nehemiah's facing these slanders. He's facing these mockings. Go back to it's Ezra chapter 4 and verse 4. This is before that letter that we're referencing here, when they wrote to Artaxerxes and accused the Jews to him. That look, if you look in the archives, you'll find this is a rebellious city. They've done that in the past. And if you let them build this city, you're going to have nothing but trouble. So you better put a stop to it. And Ezra 4 and verse 4 says, what happened? Their hands, whose hands? Is the remnant's hands were weakened, or they were discouraged from building the city. So the remnant here now, Nehemiah's day, they're not going to be intimidated. That's not Nehemiah's persona. He's not going to have any of that. You say what you want to about it. This would be Nehemiah talking. But I know what I'm going to do. And these people here, they're with me. And we're going to do this. The hand of our God is on us. So God's going to give them success. As for the enemies, as for these people now, back here in Nehemiah 2, what did he say there in verse 20? After he says, the God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, His servants, will arise and build. But about you all, what did he say? This is not even your business. Had that been said before? Yeah. Jeroboam had said the same thing about 91 years later, or earlier rather, when they came to him. Remember that group said they wanted to help? We've been sacrificing the same God that you all sacrificed to. And Jeroboam said back there, no, we have permission to do this. You don't. You have no portion in this matter. So Nehemiah is saying it too. But the difference is, back here in Ezra 4, the remnant caved in. They quit. They gave up. In this situation, Nehemiah says, there's no quit here. I mean, we're going to do it. You're not going to stop us. You're not going to bully us. You're not going to intimidate us. We're going to do this job. So I want you to be impressed with the steely resolve of this man. And what kind of resolve do you need to have when you face your mockings and your slanders? You got to dig your heels in. You're going to have to be strong. If your faith is weak and the world comes on you with its mockings and its slanders, what's going to happen to you? by and large, you're going to quit. You're going to cave into the pressure. You've got to have strong faith if you serve God. You have to have strong faith to look the world in the face and say, you know, you can say what you want, but I'm doing this because this is the Lord's will. So Nehemiah gives us a great example to follow. And I want us to be impressed with that. Okay. Anything through the first 13 questions? Anybody? Comments or questions? That's chapter 2. Obviously, chapter 3 is a long chapter, but it's a list of names. I'm not saying that to minimize it. I'm just saying it's a list of the builders. And so look, rather than going through the chapter verse by verse, I want you to look at it with me. This is the last question. Well, maybe he did. Well, maybe so. Maybe he certainly had more intimate knowledge of the king than Zerubbabel did. But did they have royal permission too? They had royal permission. Cyrus had given Zerubbabel permission. Ezra had permission from Artaxerxes. So they weren't any less authorized than Nehemiah was. But it's just the fact that in that fourth chapter of Ezra, you get the idea that they just gave up too easily. And they allowed themselves to be bullied and intimidated. And Nehemiah is not going to put up with that. He says, listen, we're doing this. This is important. And you say what you want to about it. He did. That's right. He had an answer. And what's indicated in this book so far as to his closeness with God? What's he do a lot? He prays a lot. He prays a lot. He prays about everything. And don't underestimate the value and the power of prayer. It's tremendously strong. And it's a wonderful asset. All right. So let's think about some lessons here in this third chapter. I want you to be impressed with how the project was managed. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, as you read the chapter, what impressed me was that they didn't do it as one big, gigantic job. How did they approach it? How did they tackle it? Well, yes, they divided up the wall by sections. You work on this section, you work on this part, and they just kind of divvied it all up around the perimeter of the wall. And that way, well, that does a lot of things. What does it do? Well, for starters, it facilitates getting more people involved, doesn't it? And the more you get involved in the collective work of the Lord, are you better off or are you worse off? Well, you're a lot better off. Same true for the local church today. We need more and more saints to get involved in every aspect of the work. Every aspect of it. And the more people we get involved, then the better off the church will be collectively, but each individual saint then is better off because would there not be sort of a sense of ownership? We're all participating in this. Quickly, I want you to look at Ephesians 4. I've got Ephesians 4:16 cited in the question here. I'm about out of time, so I need to hurry this up. But Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 16, actually the context is verses 11 through 16. These are the gifts or the functions that God has given the church. Talking about the edifying of the body. So the context in Ephesians 4 at this place is the collective work, the body of Christ. But look at verse 16. From whom the whole body being fitted and held together by that which what? Every joint supplies. See, we all can add something. And in this work back here, when they divvied it all up, they said, now you all supply this. This is an area that you're in charge of. You're in charge of this section. You're in charge of this section. And it gave everyone a sense of ownership. And that's building strength between the Jews. It's building connectivity, if you will. I'm struggling for words here, but I think you get the idea. And that would make the collective work a lot better, but it made them individually stronger in that which they were involved. Also, I thought this was interesting. Several were stationed and worked near their own homes. These verses there, 10, 21, 23, 28 through 30. Now, why would that be a wise thing to do? Absolutely. If they stuck you, and of course, if you love God like you ought to, and they said, now, Jeff, we want you on that wall clear across the area over there. Well, if my heart's right, I'm going to build my section of the wall clear over there as if I lived where? Clear over there. But there seems to be some wisdom here. They recognize this would again create this sense of ownership, and it would guarantee or help guarantee a higher quality of work because they live right there. So they're going to take extra precaution to make sure that this section of the wall is really built well and reinforced, fortified. See, that's wisdom. I see wisdom in that. Two of the things to notice right quick. Were there some detractors? Look at the last part of verse 5. Was everybody 100% on board? Sadly not. And in the collective work of the Lord, aren't there always some who just don't go along? I wish that wasn't so, but it is. There are always some who are not supporting the work. And those who didn't participate appeared to be leaders of some type. It mentions them as nobles or princes. So these would be people of some influence. That's not good. We want all involved. And so non-supportive leaders only discourage. They don't help encourage. They only tear it down. And we know the tragedy of that in the Lord's church today. Finally, look at this last one. There are always those who do more than their fair share as well. Look at these verses in the chapter. The text says that they did... let's see, the first verse listed there is verse 11. I closed my Bible up here and I need to get back here with the game. Nehemiah 3 and verse 11, it says, they repaired another section. Literally, it means in the text, a second measure or portion. So they finished with theirs and then went and helped did something somewhere else. So we just saw previously, there were some who weren't going to participate. They weren't going to be involved. Is that going to doom the project to failure? No, because there's always, for those who won't participate, there are those who will do what? Who will do more. And the kingdom will thrive because of those good people. And that's the case here. So there will be those who love the Lord enough to pick up the slack left behind by those who don't want to participate at all. So I see a lot of similarities between what happened with this Nehemiah wall project in the Lord's church today. It's a great practical chapter to study, or these two chapters together. Think about collective work. Okay, we'll pick up, Lord willing, then on Sunday morning with lesson 12, which is chapter 4, and that's page 29 in your books. Thank you for your